Joining us now to talk a little bit about the comeback on Netflix is the director, Colin Barnicle. Hey, Colin, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Well, I have delayed watching. Curtis got a screener and watched. I wanted to wait until today and sit down and watch all three. What was it about this project that attracted you and made you say, because it has been, the 04, the incredible season has been explored before. What was it about this that made you say, we got to have another look at it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the most covered thing maybe in sports over the last 20 years. But, you know, I used to, when I was, I worked in the clubhouse in 2007. And every time I would get off work, everybody would be like, what are the guys like in the clubhouse, you know? So I really wanted to kind of explore that because, the players are, being from Boston, you learn to dislike the Yankees at an early age. But these guys are on, 1 year, 2 year contracts. They don't hate the Yankees. So I was like, when did that start? When did the personal animosity start where the players start to be like, I just don't want to win. I want to beat the Yankees. So kind of tracking that back, like what was the beginning of it, And, it's three episodes, the first 2.5 episodes, we don't even get to, the comeback from three down. It's more like the comeback from, 85, 86 years, the comeback from, 2003, and kind of like exploring about like, how a team changed its culture from, it's really not a rivalry with the Yankees if you lose 85 straight years. So exploring how they were able to do that, how they were able to change the culture and the ownership in baseball operations. And then, most importantly, the clubhouse, you want to see what's going on in there.
Is it accurate that Robert Kraft asked you to delve into how the Red Sox would not have been down 3-0 if it weren't for Bill Belichick? No? Okay. Sorry.
We didn't get that. No.
Okay, all right.
Sorry. Colin, I think all three episodes are good. The final one was spectacular. There's things there that I think we're about the same age. I lived this like you did. I didn't know before watching it. The part that I think the comeback does a great job on, too, is the Cold War winter of 03-04, where it's pre-social media, and it's actual SportsCenter interviews that are breaking news. Could you talk about what you guys found out there and just how close the Red Sox were to landing Alex Rodriguez?
So, yeah, in that winter, Alex was, he had signed a contract. Jed Hoyer has in his files a signed contract with Boston Red Sox letterhead with A-Rod on it. And we were going to get him. It got convoluted. The Players Association basically said, you can't restructure a contract. And it was about $12.5 million. That was it. That divided the Alex Rodriguez from being a Red Sox. And right in the middle of that, you got to trade Nomar Garcia Parra, the icon of Boston, if you're getting a new shortstop. And right in the middle of that, Kevin Millar went on with Dan Patrick on ESPN. And he basically said, we'll take A-Rod over Nomar, and we'll take A-Rod over Manny. And he got in his truck afterwards. Nomar called him, rightfully so, saying, like, what was that about? And Millar, for about 15, 20 years, really thought he was like, no, I just answered a question about who was going to be throwing me the ball if I was playing first base. And we replayed the clip for him, and we said, no, they're kind of asking you who you want. And he was like, oh, okay, Nomar has the right to be mad. And so, the whole 04 team, it was like the whole culture that was created in 2003, it's kind of like almost like a Seinfeld episode. It's like, no good deed goes unpunished, That culture kind of got screwy in the beginning of 2004. And they had a comeback from that, too. Keep saying the comeback.
No spoilers here, but Curtis shared this with me, so I'll try to say it in the best way possible. You did uncover, I think for the first time, some allegations of cheating on the part of the Yankees.
Yeah, Oh, don't worry about spoilers. I've been talking to just about everybody on the street about
What did you guys uncover?
So part of it was before game two of the 2004 ALCS when Pedro was pitching. Doug Mirabelli, they're all kind of in the pitcher's room where they have their pre-meetings, and Doug Mirabelli, for whatever reason, he reached up into a ceiling panel and he found a microphone, what they thought was a microphone or looked like a microphone, and all the players thought it was a microphone. And they got very paranoid that this thing was transmitting to somewhere in Yankee Stadium, so they ended up having to do all their pitchers' meetings. They would walk out of the clubhouse, walk across the street, and they would do it in the team bus for the rest of every time they were in New York. So, yeah, I don't know. Is it real? They definitely found the microphone. I don't know why it was there. Maybe it was, a prank or whatever, but the players definitely thought there was something to it. Although they did give up 19 runs at home, so it's like, I don't know, you weren't bugging your own clubhouse.
Colin, like we've seen a lot of this stuff, and, it's been so long. Is there something in this that we're going to see that we don't know about, is completely new, or was there something new that you found out from doing this that you had no idea with all the, kind of stories that have been out for a long time?
I think we put a lot of the rumors to bed. There's the, did they take shots of Jack Daniels during it? The answer is yes, and you get to see it in this, another part, I was at Game 7, 2003, when Wakefield gave up the home run, and I was really interested in hearing from Grady Little. And we got Grady in this. And I remember at one point during the interview, he said, it's just different if you're there. And, when you're in Yankee Stadium and you have to make the decision, and he turns to me and goes, where were you? And I go, I was at Yankee Stadium. I was about four rows behind you. And he was like, oh, okay. So just hearing from him, the 360 view of kind of that, and the whole self-doubt of these people, who built this. You look 20 years back, and it seems like a fairy tale, but, it's like baseball. Like 7 out of 10 times, they made the wrong decision, either, in ownership or the front office or down in the clubhouse. Like, wasn't really preordained that this was going to happen.
I thought it was amazing that Grady Little hadn't aged. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But
oh, my God. I thought the same thing. I thought he was about 7 years old when in 2003, and then I went to visit him. I said, Grady, you look, I guess, great, right, or the same.
He's like frozen in time. But the element for me is just how loose they were. Like, we had all, obviously all the cowboy up, the idiots, all that stuff has become cliche, but the footage of the locker room, they're down 3-0 at Fenway Park. Following game 3 in my lifetime, I have never seen a team get more rightfully destroyed than that team did. It was like unleashing the fury of 86 years on players, calling them frauds. And in that morning or that midday, they're at Fenway Park watching Animal House.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. It's just a group of just guys who, Kevin Millar has a lot to do with that. Like, he made that place like a walled garden where you could, let your freak flag fly. It didn't matter who you were. You were all important. Everybody was going out together. I think Derek Lowe at one point says in the interview, we would all go to, the restaurant together, all 25 of us. And after the interview, I was like, restaurant, huh? Not a bar? And he was like,
Yeah. I'm sure he meant Daisy Buchanan's. He probably meant Daisy's, I would assume. Yeah.
Colin, you keep talking about the culture back then, and you look at the guys that were the stars on that team, and I think that's the difference between now and then. They all seemed to have this connection to Boston that we just don't get anymore. It feels like, even after they were long gone, they are still Boston athletes. They'll always be Boston athletes. Did that come across when you were talking to them, that they have a special connection to Boston that they don't necessarily have with other places or other teams they've played on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's two things. I think it's one that, Kevin Millar, he's gone. He's going to Japan. His Major League Baseball career is over. So Boston to him is like kind of the savior of his whole career. And the same thing with David Ortiz. He's released. He's not going to, you know, he's not going to be playing Major League Baseball, or he might be a backup somewhere. So it's kind of like their last chance or their first chance for Theo, someone like that, where it's just like, you know, and speaking to Derek Lowe, Derek Lowe played like 12 more major league seasons, and he was like, "Oh man, I really screwed up. I should have stayed in Boston." I was like, "You won like 150 games afterwards." And he's like, "No, I should have stayed. I should have stayed." But all those guys are just like, you know, it's the idea of feeling like you're a part of the town. And I do feel like Wake, Tim Wakefield, he had a big, big part of that. He, you know, having lived here, having been the longest tenured guy, you know, that he kind of brought them into, like, this is, you're part of the culture here. It's not just the city you're playing in. You're part of the city.
Yeah, I think David was on with us, David Ortiz, last at Winter Weekend, and he made the point that losing in 03 made him understand Boston. It was like a crash course, having never really understood this market, never been here. And then you see that. I mean, the game
that was at the Jimmy Fund.
Oh, the Jimmy Fund.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
At the game five of the ALCS remains the best game I've ever seen in person. It was the most stressful, unbelievable, exhausting existence of my life. And is Ortiz the first player in baseball history to have two walk-offs in one calendar day? That has to be, right?
Oh, he has to be. I mean, they got like no sleep during that. He was like a zombie, you know, during that whole thing. He looked, you know, he knew the whole thing kind of rested on him. And by the way, the players were not shy about it during the, they were like, "Oh no, we were all looking at him to get the big hit. We knew we weren't." Like, you know, I think Kevin Millar was like, "I'm not going to get a hit off Mariano Rivera. You know, I think I took him deep once, but I'm not going to do it. It's got to be David." So he's, you know, it's kind of when David became Big Poppy. You know, he's always been the same guy. He's always been this, like, larger-than-life guy. But that's, like, when he becomes, quote-unquote, Big Poppy.
Well, there are three episodes. It is called The Comeback. It is on Netflix now as we speak. And Colin Barnicle directed it. And thank you for taking the time to talk about it this morning with us.
No, thank you.
Okay. Curtis, you loved it, right? A+?
I mean, I could watch it. I could just watch the games again, so I may not be the best person. But it was also, and I didn't want to really get him on this because I'm sure the organization was good to him. I didn't want to put him in a bad spot. But watch it and tell me if you recognize the owners you see. Because the ones that are part of this are people that I want to run my baseball team. I don't recognize them today.